Arthur. This is his work, remember. His work in Crosby's cottage, smelted by Johnny Quee's own hand.
Perhaps Crosby Wells was in league with him, said Frost.
Was that it? Said Nielsen.
He pointed at Arquee and said, was he in league with Crosby Wells?
He not know Crosby Wells, said Arsuk.
Oh, for the love of Christ, said Mannering.
Harold Nielsen was looking from one Chinese face to the other, searchingly, as if their countenances might betray some evidence of their collusion. Nielsen was very suspicious of Chinese men, having never known one personally. His were the kind of beliefs that did not depend upon empirical fact, and indeed were often flatly disproved by it, though no disproof was ever enough to change his mind. He had decided long ago that Chinese men were duplicitous, and so they would be, whatever disproof he might encounter. Gazing at Ah Kui now, Nielsen recalled the theory of conspiracy that Joseph Pritchard had put to him earlier that afternoon.
If we are being framed, then perhaps he is too.
Someone else is behind this, he said.
There's someone else involved.
Yes, said Arsuk. Who?
Said Nielsen eagerly.
You won't get a grain of sense out of him, said Mannering. It's not worth your breath, I'm telling you.
But the Hatter did reply, and his answer surprised every man in the room.
Te Rao Ta Fare, he said.
Venus in Capricorn, in which the widow shares her philosophy of fortune. Gascoigne's hopes are dashed, and we learn something new about Crosby Wells. Upon quitting the gridiron, Aubert Gascoigne had crossed directly to the Wayfarer Hotel, so identified by a painted sign which hung on two short chains from a protruding spar. The sign boasted no words at all, but showed instead the painted silhouette of a man walking, his chin held high, his elbows cocked, and a Dick Whittington bundle on his shoulder. From the jaunty cut of the silhouette, it would not be unreasonable to assume that this was a male-only lodging-house. Indeed, the establishment as a whole seemed to suggest a marked absence of the feminine, as communicated by the brass spittoon on the veranda, the lean-to privy in the alley, and the deficiency of drapes. But in fact, these were the tokens of thrift rather than of regulation. The Wayfarer Hotel did not discriminate between the sexes, having made a firm policy of asking no questions of its lodgers, promising them nothing, and charging them only the very smallest of tariffs for their nightly board. Under these conditions, one was naturally prepared to put up with a very great deal, or so Mrs. Lydia Wells, current resident, had reasoned, having no small genius for thrift. Lydia Wells always seemed to arrange herself in postures of luxury, so that she might be startled out of them, laughing when someone approached. In the parlour of the Wayfarer Hotel, Gascoigne discovered her stretched out on the sofa with her slipper dangling free from her toe, one arm flung wide, and her head thrown back against a pillow. She was clasping a pocket-sized novel in her other hand, quite as if the book were an accessory to a feint. Her rouged cheeks and titillated aspect had been manufactured in the moments prior to Gascoigne's entrance, though the latter did not know it. They suggested to him, as was the woman's intention, that the narrative in which she had been engrossed was a very licentious one. When Gascoigne rapped upon the doorframe, as a courtesy only, for the door was open, Lydia Wells roused herself, opened her eyes wide, and gave a tinkling laugh. She closed the book with a snap, but then tossed it onto the ottoman, so that its cover and title were in the man's full view. Gascoigne bowed. Rising from the bow, he let his gaze linger upon her, relishing the sight, for Lydia Wells was a woman of ample beauty and a pleasure to behold. She was perhaps 40 years of age, though she might have been a mature-seeming 30 or a youthful 50, the precise figure she would not disclose. She had entered that indeterminate period of middle age that always seems to call attention to its own indeterminacy, for when Lydia was girlish, that girlishness was made all the more visible by the fact of her age, and when she was wise, her wisdom was all the more impressive for having been produced in one so young. There was a vixen-like quality to her features. Her eyes slanted slightly, and her nose curved upward in a way that called to mind some alert and inquisitive creature. Her lips were full. Her teeth, when she showed them, were delicately shaped and spaced evenly. Her hair was a bright copper, that colour called red by men and auburn by women, that darkens with movement like a flame. Currently it was pulled back into a chignon made of braids, an elaborate contour that covered both the nape and the crown of Lydia's head. She was wearing a striped gown made of grey silk, a sombre hue, and yet it could not quite be called a mourning dress, just as Lydia's expression could neither be called the expression of a woman nor really the expression of a girl. The dress sported a high-buttoned collar, a ruffled bustle, and puffed leg-o'-mutton sleeves, ballooning shapes which served to accent Lydia's ample bosom and diminish her waist. At the ends of these enormous sleeves, her hands, clasped together now to convey her rapture at the sight of Gascoigne standing in the doorway, seemed very small and very fragile, like the hands of a doll.
"Monsieur Gascoigne," she said, relishing the name, drawing it out, "but you are alone."
"I convey regrets," Gascoigne said.
"You convey regrets, and cause them deeply."
Lydia looked him up and down.
"Let me guess, a headache?"
Gascoigne shook his head and recounted as briefly as he was able the tale of Anna's gun misfiring in her hand. He told the truth. Lydia made noises of alarm and pressed him with questions, which he answered thoroughly, but with a deep exhaustion that showed as a tremor in his throat. At last she took pity on him and offered him a chair and a drink, both of which he accepted readily and with relief.
"I only have gin, I'm afraid," she said.
"Gin and water will do fine."
Gascoigne sat down in the armchair nearest the sofa.
"It's putrid stuff," said Lydia with relish. "You'll have to grin and bear it. I ought to have brought a case of something with me from Dunedin. Foolish in hindsight. Have not yet found a dram of decent liquor in this town."
"Anna keeps a bottle of Spanish brandy in her room."
"Spanish?"
Lydia looked interested.
"Jerez de la Frontera," said Gascoigne. "Andalusia."
"I'm sure that I would adore Spanish brandy," said Lydia Wells. "I wonder how she came by the bottle."
"I am sorry that she could not be here to tell you herself," Gascoigne said, rather automatically.
But as Lydia eased her foot back into her slipper, lifting her skirts to show the stockinged plumpness of her calves, Gascoigne reflected that he was not, in fact, particularly sorry.
"Yes, we would have had the most delicious time together," said Lydia. "But the expedition is easily postponed, and I love to look forward to an outing. Unless you would like to come shopping in Anna's